MadPipe Madcast.
Welcome to the MadPipe Madcast, where we talk about marketing strategy and bring marketing insights to businesses and nonprofits. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host, and today my guest is Shane Spencer, co-founder of ThinkWork Media in New York City, which does web development and online marketing. Shane, could you first talk for a minute about what you do?
Sure, thank you for having me, Dan. ThinkWork Media works with small to medium-sized businesses. We primarily do web development, but we also work with developing an online presence for our clients. So we help with the execution of their social media campaigns or their email marketing campaigns, or basically even as simple as pay-per-click campaigns as well.
Got it. So Shane, one of the things I want to ask you about today is how to ensure a more effective web design process. So let's say that I'm a small business owner, medium-sized business owner, or a nonprofit, and I know that I want to build a website, but I don't really know what the process is going to entail and how to go about it. And it seems like different web designers have different processes. So how could I make the experience more effective for me? Should I worry about designing a wireframe first myself? Do I need to start out with copy? What can I do to get the most out of the process?
The first thing I always suggest that people do is basically get clear on what the objectives are for the website, and then from there start working on the content. The more content you have to put together in front of the person that's going to be developing or designing your website, the easier it makes their job to be, and they can then start to lend their expertise in the situation. Looking at examples of websites you really like and putting that in front of the web developer or web designer is really helpful as well. And once you have all that stuff in place, then taking it to the web developer and designer and trusting their process. Really trusting their process. A lot of people get hung up on initially buying into the web developer's process, but then trying to then short-circuit and do their own thing or trying to fast-track things, and that can really throw wrenches in the process and make the process a lot longer than it has to be.
Well, let me ask you this. So the content, I suppose as a web designer, you probably run into situations where people are either partway through the process or even have none of the content first. What kind of challenges does that present you in terms of web development? If I don't have the main photos for the homepage or I don't have the written copy, what does that do to the process for you and how does that affect me?
It definitely slows things down and it can definitely be a lot more costly if that isn't possible. If you don't have the content, for example, if the designer doesn't really have the true text and all they're doing is lorem ipsum text, they're going to basically, in their world, design everything that's going to be perfect. So all the menu titles are going to be this big, all the blog titles are going to be this big, and so you don't really get a true aspect of what it's going to look like. And so when you get into the development phase after the design has been approved, it can be really difficult because you don't necessarily, it won't turn out exactly how it wasn't designed because in the design phase you didn't have all the proper content. And sometimes even if you go as far as starting to develop the website without the content laid together, that becomes really, really problematic because you're basically doing double work. Most of the websites that are built today are built using content management systems, CMS. And if you don't really have the content, you don't really know exactly what to tell the system to do with the content. You can say, okay, well, make it look like this, but it's not until after you really get the real content in there then you can tell the system, okay, make the padding this way, make the font color this way, do all these things, because then you're really treating the content as opposed to just treating dummy stuff. So it really can kind of slow things up.
That makes sense. What about, people do come to you with the content and they come to you with design ideas, and the pressure is to clone someone's competitor. For instance, I'm an organization that provides some kind of service, some kind of in-home medical service, and I go look for other sites that do the same thing, and I say, oh, I like this one. Can you copy that and just change the content and maybe change the colors? Is that a good practice? Is it a dangerous practice? Do you do that sort of thing? What do you think about that as a design trend?
To a certain extent, it is okay because basically, especially if you're copying a bigger organization, the way they've laid out some things are really good. I definitely don't recommend anyone copying anything pixel for pixel because people will then start to see the similarities and they'll basically ignore you and say, oh wait, this guy's just copying everything these other guys did. And there's plenty of examples of people creating knockoff websites based on other ones. So I would definitely not suggest that. best practices. So looking at how an organization lays out their content or does their menu structure could lead to how you should possibly consider doing yours as well. But copying websites pixel for pixels is not a really good idea. It basically makes you look less authentic than you're trying to be.
Yeah, and I think there's a legal component too. I've seen people come back and say, hey, you know, you copied our website and we want you to now make changes because our website is an original design and the original design is protected. And of course, the web developer may not know that. The onus is on the business owner or the nonprofit owner to make the determination where they have the rights to request what they're requesting. But ultimately, it can be bad news. And the other thing is a lot of people do it sort of across state lines. If they're a local business, they'll say, well, I'm just copying a business in Atlanta and I'm in New Jersey. But that doesn't necessarily work either because in a global online world, we can see what other people are doing if they're working at all on sort of marketing trends, etc. So it's just generally not good advice, right?
Yeah. And you're also doing yourself a disservice. So say you want to copy your competitor or someone who's very similar to your business, but they're located somewhere else. And say the person is looking to work with a different type of industry. And say they come across that particular industry. Say they come across your competitor or the company that looks like yours. And they spend time reading through their information. If they come across your website that looks basically exactly like theirs, they're going to just glance over everything because they assume that it is exactly the same, even though maybe one or two things may be different, or even though your physical business is different, if your websites are that similar, people are just going to ignore and say, oh, this person just does exactly what that other person does. I'm not really going to spend time reading through it.
There's also the issue of when you try to clone a site, you're not really thinking about the site as framing your unique content. Most likely, if you're doing a clone design, you're doing clone content too. And the fact is, as a digital strategist, I tell clients all the time, cloning content doesn't work. Every company needs its own unique voice, its unique brand, and its unique dialogue with an audience. Mm-hmm. So ideally, they come to you with original, well-written content as well as wanting an original, well-designed website.
Definitely. And furthermore, on top of that, websites today are never really built all within the one phase. So when you see a company that has a lot of pages and a huge, huge website, typically what probably happened is they built the first version of it and started adding on things. So if you're looking to jump in and create all 25 pages just because this other website has 25 pages, you could be really doing yourself a disservice because your website, you have to leave room for your website to grow. I think Mark Zuckerberg said it best, done is better than perfect.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I mean, from an SEO standpoint, it's also bad news. You get a lot more play out of releasing a new page once a week than you do, 25 pages all at once, and then the site doesn't grow after that. It's set it and forget it. And a lot of those pages, the trend now with content marketing is not to do so many pages. The other guy may have 25 static pages, but it may be a much more effective digital strategy to turn the pages into blog posts for you. And because they're more shareable, they often have more SEO value. So static pages have a place, but some content is better off in your blog and something that you can grow over time. Let me ask you about certain design trends that we see as well. So there are all these fads and bandwagons, and some of them look like they're here to stay, and they will be. They'll set the stage for web development, web design for the next few years, and others look like they're already on the way out almost as soon as they're out of the gate. So some examples are parallax sites, where you scroll and there's some kind of action that happens while you scroll. It's a big fad right now. Hero images, which, a large image that fills the entire top fold of the website. Full-page video backgrounds, which is sort of the video version of the hero image. And then, of course, we have the trend of the old-fashioned slider, the sort of embedded slideshow, which is on its way out because we have good research that says, engagement actually goes down if you make people look at a slider versus actually being able to scroll faster and not be interrupted in looking at your content. So can you comment a little bit about how you see some of the, what's here to stay, what is going to last a while, what's definitely on the way out, and how do you approach it as a web designer when someone asks you to execute something that is merely a fad and may not serve them in the long run?
The one thing we always like to do is basically say, okay, what are your objectives? now, and what are your objectives for at least a year or possibly 2 years from now? Because those are the things you really want to track, do first. Because jumping onto fad and bandwagons, so many sites are built today, and then next month they're old, they're outdated. And so it's really saying, okay, instead of trying to follow these trends, try to follow what are the business objectives and aligning the website around the business objectives. It's impossible to build a timeless site or a website that is going to basically be the same for 10, 15 years. The better thing is to basically change your website as your business structure changes, as your customer needs changes. Some of the fads or bandwagon things I would say that are probably going to be here to stay for a while are these parallax websites. Everything is now thinking within mobile first, and parallax websites allow for the content to kind of load as you're scrolling down. And these long scrolling websites are really, really good for phones because it allows a person to kind of navigate seamlessly by scrolling. We don't really mind scrolling as much because it's a simple thumbing-ish thing. I think that's going to probably be here to stay. Right now, the video page background is a big thing. I think as servers become better and our internet becomes better, we may see more and more of that. It's going to take a little while for it to adopt because there are some examples of people doing it really well, some people doing it really bad. These videos, one, they're not really that good for mobile. Most of the times when you see a video background, it's typically on the website, but when you see that same version of that website on a mobile device, it's just a completely different experience. So that may be a thing that most people might want to look out for. The sliders, I think they're going to be going away for a little while. Just because sliders, when they first came out, were intended to be a way to click through things instead of having to rely on the menu. You can rely on the sliders, but then people started adding maybe 10, 15 sliders, and no one was really interacting because it just wasn't saying anything. Some of the things that I think are also really big now that I hope will go away are these pop-ups. A lot of things now, it's very common to have, you know, within 5 seconds a pop-up to sign up for our email address in order to get these discounts and all that stuff. And these pop-ups are smarter than pop-ups way back when, so they do serve some purpose, but I think it's going to be something where people are going to just start ignoring them completely, and that's probably going to go away, hopefully within the next 2 years. But right now, it's the big trend where everyone wants a pop-up to buy this or get that. So
that's what I do with pop-ups. I frankly, you know, it's if you'd never seen one or if you'd seen one 2 or 3 times, you might be interested in what they have to say. But after your 80th pop-up on a website because you've been doing a lot of web research or whatever, you don't read them anymore. You get frustrated, you close them. And if you can't find the way to close them really quickly, you just go on to a different Google result. Mm-hmm. Those are autoplay videos. You're having a quiet night, it's 11 p.m., somebody else in the house is asleep and you're looking for something. And next thing you know, there's a blaring loud video talk and you can't figure out which tab it's coming from and how it's relevant. And maybe it delays itself for 20 or 30 seconds, so you think you're okay, you step out of the room, and there's a voice coming from your office.
Yeah.
All kinds of fun with that stuff, and not often well thought out. So, you know, I see people that choose design components or elements based on whim. So they'll come back and say, well, I saw this one site, they have a really good Twitter feed on their site, I want to put a Twitter feed on mine. And it goes back to what you were saying, I think, about objectives, is sort of who told you need a Twitter feed? Is that part of your digital strategy? Is there a business objective that leads you to that? You know, why do you even have a sidebar? Because the other site has a sidebar, or because this serves your audience for your objectives? So I think what you're saying is objectives, business objectives, which lead to digital strategy, are central to web design and development.
Definitely. Because at the end of the day, the more things you add onto the website, it's just getting just noise. And if you want people to just to request a quote, adding all these things like a Twitter feed or all these things may not necessarily make sense for your business. If you are a very social business and you're always tweeting constant stuff, then it makes sense. And if you have a lot of engagement on Twitter, it absolutely makes sense for you to have a Twitter feed so people can connect to it. But if you're looking at your analytics and no one is kind of glazing over that, then it's just noise.
Right.
You know, it's just taking up more time. And a big thing that is going to be coming into SEO and is just overall loading time. And the more things you have on the site that are just noise, the longer it's going to take to load. And you have to figure out is, okay, am I willing to spend more money to have my site load faster? Am I looking to pay more for hosting to make the site faster? Or am I just looking to just maybe take away some of these things so that people can kind of get to the information they're looking to get to?
Yeah, and even the fastest hosts, there are trade-offs. I mean, if you have 20 special features on your homepage, there's not a host on the planet that's going to be able to load that thing fast enough that you're gonna hit higher ranking than the equivalent site that's leaner and meaner within Google. Because, you know, the Twitter, there's a delay when you go to load the feed. If you're loading a Google Plus button, there's another delay. If you've got a slideshow, there's another delay. And it keeps adding on as all these scripts load. Well, let me ask you a little bit about that sort of transition that transitions us into types of website platforms. So, you know, you mentioned earlier that most websites now are built on a CMS. And for those that don't know, a CMS is a content management system like WordPress, where you can log in and update your own website. You can post blog posts, you can edit your own pages, etc. So the question I have is about pure HTML sites, which are sort of the sites of yesteryear, where the entire site was designed from scratch, it stood alone, versus the CMSs like WordPress, Joomla, Drupal. What are the pros and cons of getting an HTML site versus a site based on a CMS?
So an HTML site, you have a lot more control over what's going on, and also you have a little bit more control over the updates, as in you basically can update the site whenever you choose. And whereas some of these some things like WordPress, Drupal, and Joomla, you almost have to update the software on it whenever a new software update comes out, or whenever there's like some big massive like hack where people are getting hacked and some vulnerability is exposed, and then it's like, oh man, I have to update my WordPress, I have to update my Drupal site. The issue with just static HTML site, it becomes very, very time consuming to update the content. And that's why people created content management system. Because if I go to your website in, say, January, what other reason do I have to come back to your website, say, in June? And so that's why there's an advantage to working with content management systems. But even that, and so content management system, there's a lot of different content management systems. I would say for most businesses, for most small businesses out there, they should be working with the CMS, just because standard HTML websites that are all hard-coded, unless you have a developer that's going to really be there on staff to make update content to you, that's not really going to serve your business purpose anymore.
Yeah, it's going to be expensive. You send it out. First, you have to keep the same developer because all the code is custom, so you're tied to that developer for life. Secondly, every change or update you want to make, you got to send it out. There's a time delay, and it's costly. Mm-hmm. And third, you're not going to be blogging generally on a pure HTML site. To create a blog, you'd have to actually build a CMS, either custom or alongside of it, which has lower SEO value, or convert the site to a CMS anyway. So that's awesome. A CMS site is obviously the place to start if you're a small or medium-sized business that plans to be doing some content marketing. So let me ask you a little bit about the SEO side of things. So how has SEO changed in recent years? We talk a lot on this show, and I talk a lot as a digital strategist about SEO being sort of now, instead of technical changes to your site to try to garner more traffic or old-fashioned link building, it's content, social, and PR. And there are still some similarities with what used to be done, but it has a completely different focus. Can you talk a little bit about what you see on the ground as that change?
What I see on the ground as far as SEO within 2015 is Google is looking closer at how the site is built and what the site actually says on it than what people are stuffing into it. So the old methodology of doing a whole bunch of keyword stuffing or writing clever descriptive things in hopes that someone will click on things and hopes that Google will kind of rank it better, that's kind of going away, and Google saying, okay, what's on the page? Who's coming to the page? What are people saying about the page? And that's a lot of things you can't really control within the context of just the web development part. And that's where social and PR kind of picks up. You build it as clean as possible with making sure you're only using one H1 tag and everything else is a H2 tag or lower as far as the structure of the website. But then understanding, okay, how are people getting to this? How are people getting off of the site? Do I have links on the site? That it's a lot more strategic, and it's getting away from just, okay, here are my keywords, web developer, stuff these keywords in there, bold these things, and so therefore Google can then kind of figure out what my keywords are. And it's more strategic in saying, okay, what is the one single idea that I want for this one page? Here it is. Let's make sure that's an H1 tag. And how am I going to spread this content out to people?
So it's much more of a content-driven art than it ever was. Let me ask you a question about content as it sort of integrates with design. So there are these terms, UX, UI, user experience, user interface. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of web developers don't necessarily have both of those skill sets, or maybe not even either one of the skill sets. And so you'll see a design that has great content, but the user design, the user interface is not very intuitive. Or you'll see that the user interface is flashy and nice, it's quite beautiful, but the flow of the actual user experience through as they scroll through the website isn't ideal. It doesn't really match what it takes to convert somebody and make the sale. What is your input on how content or copy integrates with UX and UI and when you do a web design?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why you have a lot of things where you have good copy but then bad design, you have great design but bad copy and bad user experience is when things are done in silos. So the web developer doesn't ever speak to the designer during the design process and kind of sits away and does their own thing, or the designer kind of completely ignores the strategy and just designs just basically because it looks cool without any rationale understanding of how the business person works. So I definitely suggest meeting with a digital strategist that basically is going to plan out the whole plan for you. So therefore, when you then take the sections to each of the individual silos, there's all one overarching strategy. Because if you don't necessarily have one overarching strategy, each person that does their particular job is going to basically come up with their own strategy. And it's like, if you go to a general practitioner, he can probably diagnose and say, okay, you probably need to go speak to a specialist. But it's always good to go to a general practitioner first, because if you go to a foot doctor, he's going to find a reason to, you know, oh, the reason why your stomach hurt is because you've got foot pain and something like that. So I think dealing with first a digital strategist, someone who is a higher level, who kind of oversees all that, makes it so much easier to then say, web developer, here's what I'm looking to do. Here's the design. Here's that stuff. Do it. Designer, here's what I'm looking to do. Let's get done. Copywriter, photographer, here's what I'm looking to do. Because each of those people that are in those individual silos, they like to get marching orders. Because when they get their marching orders, they know exactly what the parameters are that they have to work with. If the photographer is savvy enough, and if you take your wireframe or your design concepts to that photographer and say, hey, this is what the intended layout or way that we want to build this design, and you take that to them before the pictures are taken, the output from that is a lot better. You know, one of the guys that we work with, Ed, he's really, really good at saying, hey, can I see some of the designs? And then he'll realize that a lot of the images that he has to take are in landscape. So he'll say, okay, if we're going to do landscape shots, then we want to step back, put the product there, and the background is going to be important. Or the things where it's just simple product, we want to take a lot of close-up shots with white backgrounds. Getting that strategist involved early in the concept will save the client a lot of time and will make everything seem a lot more uniform.
So, that's something that comes up a lot in my field. It sounds like you're saying there needs to be a project management component and that overall strategy should guide our decisions. And I see a lot in the digital strategy realm. You'll have a social media strategist, a PR strategist, an email marketing strategist. They all have different strategies and there's no sort of unified picture. So I'm always sort of coaching people to start with the overall digital strategy that sort of governs those pieces rather than, you don't need to buy strategy 20 times anyway.
No.
So it's nice for the UX guy or the UI guy who's designing your interface to understand what it is, the process by which people are going to be converted and how they're going to purchase your product. And that's a strategic component. As we wind down the show, Shane, I just have a couple of questions left. One of them has to do with mobile. So you talked about mobile-first design earlier. And, of course, that makes design simpler and it makes it easier to consume because a huge percentage of website visitors now, you know, maybe 50-60%, depending on the type of business, are coming at it from mobile-first. But you know, some people automatically make assumptions based on mobile that, hey, I need a mobile site, and that may not be true, or I need a responsive website, and that may not be true, because those are two different things. A mobile site is a standalone website that looks differently on mobile than it does on your desktop, and a responsive site is a way of adjusting the desktop-based site so that it flows into any screen size. And these are two different things. So can you comment on maybe when a person, how a person can make that decision? Do I need a mobile site, a responsive site, or even a mobile app, which is still yet another choice?
Mm-hmm. It really breaks down to the type of business and what the specific business industry is and what their goals are. Because, for example, if people are going onto your website to get information and then they have to call you, definitely having a mobile responsive site work, because that way they can click a button and they're already calling. But if you're building something that's very technical, like an architecture or something like that, having a mobile site, like an app or something like that, where it's like very specific things that the person can kind of do, breaks it down. But trying to take your entire complex site that has all these blueprints and all these things and trying to shove it into a responsive just for the sake of having it be mobile friendly may not make sense. So I would say for those clients that really where they get a lot of phone calls, where it's a lot of quick sale things, definitely having a mobile responsive site really work. But if your site, what you're selling is very complex, then maybe even coming out with an app or just a mobile site where people, when they're coming to your website, can do simple things. Mm-hmm. Like on my site, yes, it is responsive because we get a lot of people that are calling us from all over. And typically they just want to get in touch with us, but we're not going to put up all our designs on there because in order to really see our designs, our design portfolio, you need to go to our website to see the true beauty on it. You're not going to get the same experience on a mobile version of our website.
Yeah, the desktop experience is different, and the user experience is really guiding that. So an example we've used before is if you have one of those things where you can try on clothes virtually on a virtual model and see what the clothes might look like on you, that is more like an app than it is like a responsive website. And so because if you tried to do it and shrink it down, it's not going to be visible enough. It's not going to be a good user experience. So it's not an automatic decision is the point that, oh, I need a mobile responsive site because someone else does, or I need an app because someone else has it. Mm-hmm. It really is based on your strategy and what your unique business user experience is going to be. Let me ask you a final question then as we close the show, and that is about pricing. So it seems like that just like for graphic design, website pricing is all over the map. You can get a website for $500. I wouldn't, but you could. You can get a website. These days, any kid in the garage can design something anyway that stays on the web. You can get a website for $500. You can get a website for $15,000. And I want to know, how do I know as a business owner or a nonprofit how much I should be paying? How do we structure that arrangement? Should I be paying by the hour, a flat rate? How do I know how to gauge what it's worth? Does that make sense?
Gotcha. Yeah. And I get this question asked a lot. Like, okay, so what should I be paying, or how things work? And it really starts out first as a business decision and figuring out, okay, as far as my marketing and sales, what can I budget? And then from there, you have to look at put into two buckets here. One part, you basically split it in half. One part is going to be for developing the actual site. The other part could be developing the content, because people basically lump those things together and they have they spend all their money developing, but they have no money for the content, and the content is just important. As far as the pricing structures depending on who you're working with, and it all comes down to time and resources. The more complex your website is, the more people you're going to need to be on the team to build your website. But if your website is simple, then yes, it can be built by one or two people. But the bigger your websites are, the more things you're going to need. The more complex your website are, if it's a business where there's a lot of people that want to go in there and do a lot of things, like I suggested, try on clothes virtually, that's going to need someone to build it, to design it, to then QA test it, to find bugs. There's a lot of different things going on there. For most people, I would say it first starts out a business decision, figuring out exactly what is in your budget that you want to spend on marketing, because it's more of a marketing decision as far as your budget, and then figuring out what's going to get the best bang for your buck there. And I would say whenever possible, spend the money on the content than the actual development and design of the site. Web people generally charge one of two ways. Either A, they charge flat rate, which will then restrict you in the amount of revisions you're going to have and the amount of functionality you're going to have. The other way is hourly, which works for some people, but then it can get really expensive, because especially if the person is constantly billing you and running hours for things that you'd basically rather them not spend their time on. So it really depends first on a business decision and your budget, what can you afford to spend on the content and then on the development, and then figuring out how flexible do I want to be. Do I want to be flexible in where that I can make changes on the fly, and so definitely an hourly rate would be better for you, or do I want to go a flat rate where I know exactly what I want, I don't foresee myself going out of the functionality, then a flat rate makes sense.
You've been listening to the MadPipe Marketing Madcast, where we talk about marketing strategy and bring marketing insights to businesses and nonprofits. To get more episodes like this, visit us on iTunes or Stitcher, or just visit madpipe.com/podcast. Shane, thank you very much for being on the show today. It's been great.
Thanks for having me.
The MadPipe Madcast.